So my theme for this evening is metta, loving kindness, metta, maitri, a central Buddhist quality, Buddhist virtue. I think on the program it said radical metta. Anyway, just to remind us that metta is a really radical quality. So it's not like there's metta and radical metta. Just me kind of, in a way, reminding myself, I suppose, that was what one of the things I wanted to draw out was its radical nature. So I really enjoyed last week listening to Jayaratna tell us a bit of a story about his life, his spiritual journey, his practice. So I thought I would do a little bit of the same, share some of my personal story, and also a few other stories, one from the Dalai Lama, and one from someone called Ajahn Brahm. So they're just books I've been reading recently. So as a child, or perhaps more kind of what I'm thinking back to is adolescence. So as a young adolescent, 13 or so, I think I was quite serious. I think it had started to dawn on me that there were lots of things happening in the world that were unpleasant, distressing, that there were lots of people who had lives that were a great deal harder than mine. And so I think I felt I felt serious. I felt quite, at times, overwhelmed. Just affected by it. And I used to write letters, those Amnesty International letters, about people who were facing the death penalty. So I think at times I felt quite weighed down. I was just kind of starting to grapple with what do I do about this world out there? So I had a sense of I want to try and help reduce suffering in the world. I probably wouldn't have used that language then, but that was the kind of urge. And I think as I grew up, that felt like something that I was trying to work out how I would steer towards that, kind of navigate by that. And I think I was quite idealistic, and at times in a way quite judgmental. I think it was, later on it started to dawn on me that the idealism, the ethics that I felt very committed to, very positive about, actually had a kind of, in my life, a shadow side, that they could lead to me being rather judgmental of anything that didn't kind of measure up to those ideals. I remember reading an article in a newspaper on tolerance when, I don't know, I must have been sort of 17 or so, and thinking, yes, what an important quality, and that I believe in tolerance. And then a little thought came up that was, except those people who aren't tolerant. Not very tolerant of them. And then there was probably another little bubbling up, except those other people who behave really badly. And just that sense, I had a kind of uncomfortable sense of like this value that I felt drawn to, and yet there were all these kind of caveats that seemed to want to rush in. So in my 20s, in the 1990s, I'd found what was going to be my way of trying to save the world, and I was working in international development. I'd studied that for quite a few years, and then I was volunteering because it was very hard to get a paid job in that sector. So I was doing various volunteering roles with organisations like Amnesty and Save the Children. I had a sense of this is where I want to channel my energy. This is how I want to change the world for the better. And I'd been along to the London Buddhist Centre, and looking back on it, I went for myself. I went looking for something for me, and I didn't at that time, in my early 20s or mid 20s, I didn't understand, I didn't get the altruistic, in a way, purpose of the London Buddhist Centre. It was only later, I think, that it kind of sunk in, and I started to understand that it, in its own way, was also trying to save the world, trying to make the world a better place. But I think, you know, I went for me and what I might get out of it. And at that particular time, in a way, it didn't particularly seem to meet my needs. So I kind of, you know, arrived and then sort of wandered off again. And, kind of threw myself into this world of international development. And I had a really significant moment for me, which a few of you might have heard me talk about before, because it was just one of those kind of moments of wake-up call or kind of reorientation. So I was working in a little team at one of these charities and supporting quite a senior woman in the organisation who was... What would it have been? There was a refugee crisis. I can't now remember which one it was, but that was one of the things that our team was responding to. And she'd been out and about, I don't know, doing press conferences or speaking at places. And her PA, her secretary, had needed to get hold of her for a few things. So I knew that this woman was looking out for her. And towards the end of the day, she came back into the office, and this woman, her secretary, tried to kind of get hold of her. And it's a bit of a caricature now in my mind. I don't know how accurately I remember it, but it was a kind of an image of this woman being sort of swept aside because the senior person had much more important things to do. She said something like, "Oh, I can't deal with you now. I'm dealing with a refugee crisis. I can't deal with you now." And sort of brushed this woman aside. And it was just a moment where I had a really sinking feeling, and I just thought, that could be me in a few years. I could be feeling very self-important and also, you know, I don't mean to judge her too harshly, but, you know, caught up in the importance of what I'm doing. And it is important, that work. But somehow losing sight of the people immediately around you, who for whatever reason don't appear to be important people or high status people or immediately related to the important pressing mission that you have. And I think because I had been going to the London Buddhist Centre and something in it had kind of filtered through that made me think it's not just the goal and the cause that I'm pursuing that matters, that is of value, it's how I go about it and how I treat anyone in my life who I'm interacting with. So it just felt important. I think it was because it landed. I think there was probably something in me that was kind of quite pleased with myself for having got a role in this organisation and felt, you know, that I was doing something valuable. So it was something in me, probably, that was feeling a little inflated and looking forward to probably being even more inflated, that just thought, oh dear, I don't want to encourage that tendency in myself. So, it was just quite a moment for me. So rolling forward a few more years coming into the millennium, so 1999, right at the end of that year, into the year 2000, And I went on a New Year's retreat, which was run by the London Buddhist Centre, and took over a school, a boarding school in the countryside. So there was space for 100, slightly more than 100 of us, I think, on this big retreat. So I think it was the first, it was certainly the first big retreat that I'd been on. And I just had a few kind of quite sobering experiences of seeing my mind and seeing particularly the judging mind at play, romping about, judging away, all and sundry around me. And I think that's quite a familiar experience. I think quite a few people, when they start to meditate and they start to do the metta bhavana, which sounds like a very promising, lovely experience, and then they sit down to meditate, and actually what comes up is quite the reverse of what we were hoping for, and is kind of our mind running amok and not being at all loving, but being full of criticism and judgment and irritation or whatever it might be. So I think that was kind of my moment for having a really full-blown exposure to what my mind could get up to, my judging mind. And we were all in smaller groups because the 100 people was probably a bit much to take in, really. So we were in smaller groups of maybe 8 or 9 people. And just, you know, sharing. We'd come together once a day and talk about our meditation, reflect on the talks that had been given during the day. And I suppose connecting with people in a way, in quite an intimate, open way, in quite an unusual way. It wasn't the normal kind of, where do you live? What do you do? What's your work? You know, we weren't kind of meeting in quite that. We were meeting in a different way. And, just sort of sharing in a more inner, about our more inner experience. So, because I, in a way, was in that situation where you just hear just very open sharing from people, my experience was that I felt very moved by everyone in my group. And by the end of the week, I felt very connected to them, very warm and very caring towards them. And then somehow, right at the end, There was this kind of move back into perhaps the normal mode of life and a bit more sharing about, you know, what do you do back home in your ordinary life when you're not on retreat. I've just got this memory of a woman saying that she was a hairdresser. I saw my mind have a bit of a response to that that wasn't a particularly positive response. It was a bit of a judging response. And you might think, what is so bad about being a hairdresser? There could have been all sorts of other things that she might have done that could have been much worse. But I think what it did is it just flipped me back into that that perspective where I was dividing the world into people who were trying to save the world and really put their energies in that important direction, particularly international development. Maybe a few other sort of acceptable categories, and then all the rest of the people who were not making a particular effort to save the world. And so unfortunately hairdressing for me at that time seemed to fall into the not trying to save the world category. But it was just because I was on retreat, it was like I had quite a few minds there. So there was that little sort of uprising of judging mind of my kind of that habit, that pattern of saying, oh, you could be doing something more helpful. So there was that little thought. But then there was also my retreat mind, which was much more appreciative, open, receptive, and unjudging. So it was like they kind of, the two of them, like both were there kind of eyeing each other up, these two minds trying to make, you know, work out what to make of each other. So, so again, it was just, it stayed with me as a moment of just seeing how very conditional my concern for people, my care was, you know, how many limits I was putting onto the people I was going to be responsive to and who I would have time for and time to care about and respond to. And swathes of the world who I seem to have been not so willing to respond to. And I think it was just kind of realising, oh, I'm really being quite conditional and quite limited about this. And so I loved that retreat. It had a very strong effect on me. And from that retreat, and then carrying on going to the London Buddhist Centre, I think one of the things that happened to me at that time is that I fell in love. You were talking about falling in love last week, weren't you, Jayaratna? So I fell in love with the metta bhavana, or with the idea of metta. This practice, this kind of huge, ambitious, incredible practice which culminates in connecting with loving kindness for all beings, wherever, whoever. I think it just really got hold of me somewhere. And I think I actually bored quite a few people in the rest of my life telling them about how marvellous it was in that, you know, slightly evangelical mode when something first kind of really grabs you. So, so it just it is this really radical quality, because it's not just metta for good people, not just metta for people who are trying to save the world or people who are deserving in some way because they've had a tough time. It is metta for everyone. So it's metta even for people that I disapprove of. Metta even for people who don't like me. Even for people who I think misjudge me or criticise me. Even for people who I think do things that are unethical. Because it's not about, metta is not about me approving of them or even liking them, but somehow finding it possible to wish them well, to wish that their life improves rather than gets worse, to wish that positive things unfold for them and that they become happier rather than sitting there wishing that actually things would get worse for them. So, you know, that's more doable than thinking that I've got to approve and like of them and like them. In fact, that wouldn't always be sensible or realistic, the approving part, certainly of their behaviour. So, yeah, so it's kind of a practice of like even those people, even them. So I wonder, who might they be for you? Who are your even them people who are at the kind of the threshold, the working ground of where it feels really quite a big ask to wish them well, to have a sense of metta for them? So I'm going to share a couple of other stories for you that I've heard over the years and been inspired by, and I've come across both of them like afresh again in these books that I've been reading. I might read you a bit so you get a bit of the flavour in the words of the people themselves. So the first one is from this book called The Book of Joy. It's conversations between the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. And this is a bit where the Archbishop comments that deep down we grow in kindness when our kindness is tested. So like when it's hard, when it's hard to feel kind or loving, but we hang in there, I guess. That's when our kindness grows. And the Dalai Lama agrees with him, and he says, "That reminds me of my friend, Lapon Lar. who told me about being sent to a Chinese gulag at the time I escaped from Tibet. They arrested many people. About 130 were sent to a very remote area, like during Stalin's rule when people were sent to Siberia. And after 18 years of hard labour, my friend Lopan La was able to come to India. And he told me what had happened during his time in the work camp. They had no shoes, no shoes even during the very coldest of days. Sometimes it was so cold that when you spit, it would land as ice. They were always hungry. One day he was so hungry that he tried to eat the body of one of the other prisoners that had died. But the flesh of the dead person was frozen and too hard to bite. Throughout the whole time, they tortured the prisoners. There is Soviet-style torture and Japanese-style torture and Chinese-style torture. And at this camp, they combined them all into an immensely cruel kind of torture. When he left the camp, only 20 people had survived. And he told me that during those 18 years, he faced some real dangers. I thought, of course, he was talking about dangers to his life. But he told me that he was in danger of losing his compassion for his Chinese guards. And the journalist narrating the story says, I could hear a gasp in the room at this extraordinary statement, that the greatest danger for this man had been the risk of losing his compassion, losing his heart, losing his humanity. So I don't know when I first read that story. It is, it's quite something, isn't it? That kind of, I don't know that I can quite imagine it. I think particularly when I first read it, I didn't almost quite believe it. But I think over the years, I do believe that that was his aspiration, and that was deeply, deeply important to him, to maintain that practice of metta, of compassion. In the face of all kinds of actions that at this point my metta would not, I'm sure, be able to stand up and withstand. So in one way it feels like this extraordinary far off aspiration. And at the same time it does really inspire me, a bit like a kind of North Star off in the distance. Feels very, very far from me, and at the same time it is something that I could either steer nearer to or further away from. So it is like a kind of compass point, like a bit of a guide. So that's pretty radical, isn't it? That is quite a radical aspiration to have. Perhaps in a more, less... put in a less kind of extreme way, but similarly radical, on a retreat with Sadanandi, I remember her saying, metta is just simply the most appropriate response to any situation, to any person. And I could feel my mind kind of waking up and going, are you sure? Any situation? I'm sure there are some when there would be something else that would be a, you know, kind of, my mind started like running through scenarios, trying to find some situation where metta would not be quite the best thing, some other thing. And there may be a whole array of qualities that are appropriate, but actually a sense that metta is a key central foundational one, that as well as whatever else is valuable to bring in, metta is really key. So that does stand me in good stead sometimes when I'm in a difficult situation and thinking what to do. And I sometimes manage to remember that and think, Metta is the most appropriate response to this situation. How can I find a way of that being present, or of kind of trying to move in that direction a little bit? I'm going to read you one more story. It's not quite so sobering, you'll be glad to hear. So this is from Ajahn Brahm. It's a book that I gave a Bayanara for, I think, Christmas one year. It's called Don't Worry, Be Grumpy. So it's got lots of good teachings for me in it. And they're all very nice and short, so they make a good little pithy teaching. So this one begins with an abbot waking early in the morning. Nothing unusual in that. But this morning he was awakened by the sound of something moving in the nearby shrine room. And that was unusual, because most of these monks at that time would be practicing their morning chanting, also known as snoring. So he went to investigate. In the darkness, he saw a silhouette of a hooded figure. It was a burglar. "What do you want, my friend?" said the abbot kindly. "Give me the key to the donation box," said the burglar, brandishing a long, sharp knife. The abbot saw the weapon, but felt no fear. He felt only compassion for the young man. "Certainly," he said, slowly handing over the key. As the thief frantically emptied the box of cash, the abbot noticed that the robber's jacket was torn and his face pale and gaunt. "When was the last time you've eaten, my boy?" "Shut up," barked the burglar. "You'll find some food in the cupboard next to the donation box. Help yourself." The thief paused a moment in confusion. He was taken aback by the abbot's consideration for his welfare. Still, pointing the knife at the monk just in case, he hurriedly filled his pockets with cash from the donation box and food from the cupboard. "And don't call the cops, or else," he shouted. "Why should I call the police?" answered the abbot calmly. "Those donations are to help poor people like you, and I have freely given you the food. You have stolen nothing. Go in peace." The next day, the abbot explained what had happened to his fellow monks and to his lay committee. They were all very proud of their abbot. A few days later, the abbot read in the newspaper that the burglar had been caught robbing another house, and this time he was sentenced to 10 years in jail. Just over 10 years later, the same abbot was woken up early in the morning by the sound of someone in the shrine room. He got up to investigate. And yes, you've guessed it, he saw the same old burglar standing next to the donation box. "Remember me?" said the burglar. "Yes," groaned the abbot, reaching into his pocket. "Here's the key." Then the burglar smiled and said gently, "Sir, put away the key. I couldn't stop thinking about you all those long days in prison. You were the only person in my entire life who was kind to me, who actually cared about me. Yes, I have come back to steal again, but I realised that last time I took the wrong thing. This time I have come to take your secret of kindness and inner peace. That is what I really wanted in the first place. Please hand over the key to compassion. Make me your disciple." Soon after, the thief became a monk and became rich beyond his wildest dreams. not with money, but with a wealth of kindness and inner peace. This is what we all really want. What a steal. It's got quite an archetypal feel to it, doesn't it? But again, it just, doesn't it, embody this kind of radical response of metta from someone who's really put in the years practicing metta. And so it comes out in a situation where, in a way, our natural response is to be defended, guarded, not to respond with love to this person who is behaving so very badly. So yeah, those are stories that I just bring to mind, and they kind of feel like they get me back on track when I'm not responding with metta. So coming back a bit closer to home, I don't know if anyone was listening to BBC Radio Shropshire this morning. So I was on the radio. Annette has done a fantastic job in contacting the radio and newspaper and trying to get a bit of publicity for our spring fair and other events. So a very nice radio journalist came along to the centre on Monday to do a little interview with me about the centre and the journey we've been on since we bought the building and some of the fundraising events that we're having. He was very nice, and he did a very good job on this interview. And he picked up on a phrase that I'd used that I was barely aware of having used it, but he asked me about what was the significance of this place, what was its importance, what it meant to me. And I said that it was a home in a way. It was like a home away from home, a second home, a place that could feel like home for people. So he really picked that up in his little program. And quite often, people coming along to the centre, encountering the Dharma, whether it's here or in some other context, will say that they have a feeling of coming home, that there's something in it that feels familiar and important, and like they've come back to something that they already knew that was in them. So a sense of kind of homecoming. So yeah, so the centre is great. I hope that it does feel like a bit of a second home for some people. But the best place, the best home, I was thinking, the best dwelling place is this quality of metta. That is the best place for our minds to live, for our minds to dwell, as much as they can, to dwell in a space of metta, of loving kindness. Thich Nhat Hanh, when he's writing, talking about the Brahma Viharas, he talks about them as, I think, something like the best address in town. So the Brahma Viharas are these, the literal translation is divine abodes, divine dwelling places. And they are metta, loving kindness. And then the other qualities are rooted in metta. So when metta meets suffering or difficulty, it is transformed into compassion. And when metta meets delight, joy, happiness, perhaps in a friend or in anyone we might meet, then that metta is transformed into a quality called mudita, or sympathetic joy. So taking delight in the happiness of others. And metta is also the foundation of equanimity, the last of the Brahma Viharas, of being able to meet both suffering and joy without being swept about, blown about by them, but with an equanimity. So these divine abodes, they are the best address in town. So in terms of Shrewsbury, I was thinking it's not Quarry Place, or Kingsland Road, or I don't know, wherever else would be, a really swanky pad. Actually, the best address in town, the best home that we can have, is abiding in metta, in loving kindness, which is what we sometimes get a glimpse of in our meditation or other times during our day, for whatever blessed reason that something of metta is present in our experience. So I was thinking of that quote from the Dhammapada about living, live in love, not in hate, live in love. Metta is very good for our minds. It's good for the world as well, but it's very good for our minds. And I think it's good for the brain. I've been studying a bit of neuroscience recently. Things like anger and hate are not particularly good for the brain. Particularly kind of heightened and chronic when they continue on and on, and are a source of great agitation and stress to us. They will unleash lots of cortisol in our brain, which apparently is called neurotoxic, which means toxic to the brain. So it'll actually damage the brain when we kind of have emotions that flood us with that degree of stress, anger. And of course, if we have those thoughts full of anger and hate, they, in the traditional Buddhist image, they dig grooves, don't they? They dig grooves in our mind that just get deeper and deeper ruts and habits that kind of pull us. So it's really worth putting in a bit of effort to try and... what's the word? You know, pull in, resist that gravitational pull, kind of push back that particular tide. So I was thinking, I don't think I often, if ever now, experience hatred. Perhaps I do, and I'm just not clocking it just now. It doesn't feel like something that's at that kind of strength comes up very often for me. But I do definitely experience a number of things that are the raw ingredients of hatred. The raw ingredients that can very easily be cooked up quite nicely and turned into hatred if they're allowed to kind of ferment away. So things like fear, which I experience, aversion, a kind of withdrawing, disliking of something in my experience, irritability, resentment. So all of those things are like, they're kind of the raw ingredients that if left unchecked, if I kind of feed them consciously or unconsciously, they are the kind of the ingredients that can bake you a nice big cake of anger and hatred. So like a mantra for me, a phrase I find really helpful is, don't manufacture hatred out of pain. Don't manufacture hatred out of pain. That really resonates with me. I just think, yes, that is exactly what I can do, is I have a painful experience and then I'm like a little kind of factory that gets to work manufacturing with that raw material of pain, manufacturing, who can I blame? Who can I be cross with? How can I, in a way, push out rather than in with this unpleasant feeling that I don't want? So I was just kind of pondering how do I try and work with that? When I feel upset, triggered, fearful, when it feels hard to cultivate metta for someone, kind of what do I do in that situation? I think that one of the key things that I do is reflect on conditions, is reflect on conditionality. So I think about the conditions that may have led to this point for that in that particular person that have produced the actions, the words that are at that are difficult for me. So sometimes I can actually imagine, or I might have a bit of a sense if I know the person, of those conditions. Sometimes I can actually engage with the specifics of like what might have led to them doing something that I'm now finding difficult. Sometimes I don't know, or don't know them well enough. So it's more just knowing the general teaching of conditionality. There will be conditions, there will be things in their life, in their childhood, that have led to this outcome, led to this being in a way the best that they can come up with at this point in time. So kind of this reflection on conditionality, trying to take that dharmic perspective, is for me often a really helpful way in to just trying to get a little bit of wriggle room with some of those difficult emotions, trying to shift them a little bit. So it's not I'm not having to say that what people have done is okay. I'm not having to kind of approve of it. It's just acknowledging their conditioned nature, and that that person is not inherently, unchangeably, fixedly evil, but they are the fruit of conditions, and if the conditions change, then so will they. So, before we take a tea break, I'll just say a little bit about how I might use that in the Metta Bhavana, in the Metta Bhavana meditation. Which I think one of these days we really should do a whole course on the Metta Bhavana. I know some people love it, but I also know quite a few people find it challenging. For all sorts of different reasons, actually. I think it's quite interesting talking about the reasons. I think people can find very different things about it challenging. But anyway, when I think about how I do the Metta Bhavana, I do not try to feel loving. That is not my starting point. In fact, I don't try to make myself feel anything. That seems, in my experience, to be fairly fruitless to try and feel something, or try and make myself feel something. So I tend to just start by noticing how I am feeling. Or maybe I bring a person in one of those stages to mind and just spend a bit of time acknowledging how I do feel and bringing them to mind. I might feel fearful, irritated, and that might be something that I'm not surprised at. I expected that emotion to come up, or sometimes it might be a bit of surprise. I might be thinking of my friend and suddenly some unexpectedly irritable, difficult emotions come up because, I'd forgotten that actually the last time we met things weren't so straightforward. I just spend a bit of time really experiencing in my body what it feels like to bring them to mind. What is the actuality of being present with them? And then sometimes I might actually spend also a bit of time acknowledging if there seem to be any particular kind of needs or wishes or longings coming up in me. So like wishing that they could see things from my perspective, wishing that they could understand, wishing that they could know the impact, the effect of things that they've said and done, wishing that they might understand, regret, apologise, whatever it is. So in a way, if that's coming up, just acknowledging that there is that kind of, that energy, that that wanting. And then I'll drop in this kind of reflection on conditionality. A sense of, their life, they have been shaped by all sorts of conditions. That is a kind of fundamental truth. And whether I'm kind of dwelling with the detail or just a sense of that they are a conditioned, changing being. And part of that is reflecting on a sense of our of their humanity, our shared humanity, of how much we are the same, and that we are both in a way oppressed by craving and hatred or aversion, craving, aversion and delusion, ignorance. We will both be oppressed and tossed about by wanting things, not wanting things, and being confused and not understanding the nature of ourselves. So that helps as well. That's that sense of like being in a certain way in the same boat. And then in a way I connect back with that aspiration that I talked about, in a way that these two stories evoked in a very kind of full-blown way, but that aspiration to contribute to there being more metta in the world rather than more hatred. So I might not feel particularly loving, might not feel anything particularly strongly, but there's, I suppose, a knowing in me that I do believe metta is the best response. And I would like to, for some of my energy to be going into responding with metta rather than its opposite. So it's kind of knowing deep down that matters to me and that I hope to be able to steer by it. And that may or may not translate into a feeling. Sometimes it does translate into a little bit of kind of softening, a little bit of kind of opening, a little bit more receptive to the other person. But in a way, it's just recontacting that intention, that value, rather than any particular feeling. So that's in a way a particular way of engaging with the metta bhavana. So I'm going to give you just maybe 5 minutes. Just we might turn the lights on. Actually, it's got a bit dark, isn't it? But just 5 minutes to chat with one other person. Just what do you think of that way of engaging in the metta bhavana? Do you think that would work for you or not? Just kind of in a way, process a little bit what you make of that as a way of engaging in the metta bhavana. And I'll ring a bell in 5 minutes or so. Mm-hmm.